Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Benjamin Ehrlich, author of The Brain in Search of Itself, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, and The Story of the Neuron, released earlier this year by FSG. Benjamin is also the author, serendipitously, of The Dreams of Santiago Ramón y Cajal, which was published by the Oxford University Press. His work has appeared in the Paris Review, Nautilus Magazine, the New England Review, where he serves as a senior reader. So, well, I won't say that Benjamin is obsessed with Santiago, but he is obsessed with Santiago.
It's fair.
As a bookseller, I've always said, if you're going to be addicted to something, books aren't a bad way to go compared to like gambling, drugs, or alcohol.
Absolutely.
And to be addicted to The Neuron and the man who may not have discovered it, but gave it to us by way of an artistic message that's sublime in its precision and beauty, and without which we would be poorer, both aesthetically and in terms of the science that has drawn upon Santiago's work for over a century, and still does for that matter, and for which he won the Nobel Prize, a scarce commodity amongst Spaniards. He is a Spanish national treasure. And perhaps the best thing about Benjamin's work is that without him, almost all of us would be ignorant of the genius of a man. He was so focused on his work that he gave up much of an ordinary man's life in order to enrich his own in other ways and to give us a vision of the brain, the mind, and the heart of human consciousness. So welcome, Benjamin, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. That was a beautiful introduction. I'm very grateful for that. Thank you.
Well, you know, you gave me the introduction because, again, as a bookseller, if you read the book, then you should be able to talk about it.
Well, if you write a book, it helps to be obsessed as well. So it's obsession can work both ways, I think.
That's true. That's very true. And I often start, again, not to beat a dead horse, but as a bookseller, you know, and I say this every single interview, people say you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover.
Right.
And this is a great one because it's this great picture of Santiago that somehow, well, obviously you picked it for a specific reason. Why did you pick it?
Well, he was a fan of self-portraiture, and oftentimes he would pose himself as he hoped to be seen by probably someone writing a book in 100 or so years, because that was his image of himself. And I like the smock, and I like the cluttered table with multiple microscopes, and I especially like the sort of crowd of bottles on the shelves, you know, it kind of almost like alchemical feeling of what was going on inside the lab. And his sort of brooding expression is also quite charming, I find.
Oh, hold up the book, if you have it there.
Yeah.
Because that'll give people, it's been on our front table because it was released, like I said, earlier this year. And that gives you a good idea. Even the background of The Neuron and the coloring is really good. People like that kind of color.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and the title. I mean, and I'll go through what the bookseller is interested in. So the title, the subtitle, The Story of the Neuron, it's kind of like you're taking both on, right? It's him, and the separate part of it is the story of the neuron and what it is and how it works, right?
Yeah, I found them to be actually quite inseparable because I think calling the book The Story of the Neuron is a nod towards how subjective science can be, especially in those days of descriptive anatomy. The tools were primitive enough that scientists had to interpret their findings and then provide explanations, physiological explanations for the anatomy that they uncovered. Cajal saw himself in the neuron and projected a lot of his qualities onto the neuron, and therefore it sort of retained some of like his characteristics. And that's the neuron, his vision of the neuron that became the foundation of modern neuroscience. So I was kind of surprised, pleasantly, to find that science could be so personal. And his neuron is really the best example of that.
Which leads me to the final issue with regard to what readers are looking for, and I'm just looking it up now, but you can certainly read it, is I'm always interested in epigraphs because I figure the authors spent a lot of time thinking of those words, because kind of like the outside of a jigsaw puzzle representing what's going to be inside when you put it together. So, you know what, and they're short. Why don't you just read both, and we can talk about, especially Don Quixote, because it's like his hero.
Yeah, so first is, I know who I am and who I may be if I choose. That's from Don Quixote, as you said. And the next one is, every man, if he is so determined, can become the sculptor of his own brain, which is Cajal.
And they're both kind of the same sentiments to a certain degree, which I'll start off the beaten track, but it's not so off. If we talk about, you know, the Platonic dialogue, Gorgias, Santiago, and solipsism, not that he was a solipsist, but, you know, the way he was, he liked to mess around with his schoolmates. And, you know, as Gorgias said, it's, if even if nothing exists, if it does exist, it's incomprehensible to humans. And third, even if that existence is apprehensible, it can't be communicated or interpreted to its neighbors, to one's neighbors. But he wasn't a solipsist, but he kind of got off on it, right? In a way.
Well, that's why I called the book The Brain in Search of Itself, because there is this kind of seductive, recursive aspect to a person whose brain is, if we believe the fundamentals of neuroscience, generating, let's say, behavior, vision, you know, mental formations, and that would, the lens of that would be turned onto the very thing that the brain is composed of. It's like, who's searching for who, you know? The neuron, you know, he's sort of marshaling his neurons to search for the, you know, fundamental image and identity of a neuron. And so I do think there's like a recursive loop there. I think his solipsism was more like an adolescent party trick, you know, just to, he had kind of a, I think he was probably a difficult person to speak to or to be friendly with, because he was so tough-minded and also had a very dark sense of humor.
Yeah, it's funny because I guess we should talk about his childhood, because in some ways that also sculpted his brain, his mind. Talk about his dad and then talk about his private schools and how the kids didn't like him and all that stuff.
Yeah, so his father was such an outsized influence on his childhood. It's the whole first third of the book is really the story of that relationship. His father was his hero, I believe. He was a self-made man, born illiterate, taught himself to read as an apprentice to a barber surgeon, which is quite a medieval art, because that's how backwards the north of Spain was in terms of a scientific environment. His father worked to eventually earn his doctorate in medicine and was forcing Cajal to follow in his footsteps, but Cajal wanted to be an artist. His father said art was a dilettantish waste of time, and so on. So he would destroy his artwork. And there was a sort of battle between the two of them that unfortunately culminated in some physical abuse by his father, which I think wounded Cajal beyond, I don't think he could really accept or process that, as we, you know, process is sort of a modern word, but his father sent him to these religious schools. The motto, which you can see from a Goya painting, is La letra con sangre entra, which means knowledge comes with blood. So he was imprisoned, tortured, beaten, all because he didn't want to learn what they were teaching. They taught Latin declensions, and he was a visual learner, and he wanted to draw, and he wanted to be an artist. And eventually, anatomy, which his father introduced him to, which is part of why it's so complex, became Cajal's subject for drawing. That was his way into science, was as the human body as a subject for drawing. By the end of his life, he was not speaking to his father because his mother was on her deathbed and his father had an affair with like a 26-year-old woman from a village he was making his rounds in. So, you know, a truly amazing, I think I read in the book that if Cajal's father had never had a son, he would have been the most famous person in the family, because he did live quite a remarkable life, but very complicated man, violent, also I think somewhat brilliant, and is responsible both for the wounds that Cajal carried out of his childhood and for the vocation that became the foundation of his Nobel Prize winning career.
Yeah, early on I kind of got confused. Is this his dad or is this him? And then it's funny because the time that they seem most closely bonded is when they're walking through graveyards, finding old bones to take home. And then coincidentally with that, you put that great Leonardo quote in there. Be careful what you wish for if you want to dissect stuff, because you're going to wake up in the middle of the night and go screaming like Halloween's coming up.
I have a friend who is an MD, PhD, and I said to him, I'd like to see a dissection, you know, so I can get some material for my book. And he said, trust me, you don't want to see it. It could scar you forever. And so I don't have the stomach that Leonardo developed and Cajal developed. I shied away.
I have the same feeling. Like, I really would like to do that, because I like looking when my blood is drawn. I love looking at it, whereas other people faint. So I figure, maybe I could do it. But
the whole other level, I think, when you're
But that's the way my life has been, making some mistakes like that. It's funny though, a lot of the book is, you're relying on his autobiography to a certain extent. And at the same time, you're saying, you know, he might be quite exaggerating quite a bit. So what were the feelings you had about, like, and you know, it's really good at the end, you know, I think it's at the end where you say, look, I'm being subjective. I realize I'm being subjective. Notwithstanding that, kind of, we all are, and please basically indulge me in that subjectivity, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the 21st century, as far as literary theory and our understanding of the limits and reaches of literature, you can't be authoritative and definitive in an objective way. I think we've all, there's too much about perspective and identity to actually fall for that. So in reading Cajal's autobiography, I recognize that, of course, it's a document of self-presentation. It's not even to be relied upon as necessarily a record of facts, but it was rich because he was inspired by Spanish literature to create his own story. And that's part of why I call the book, the subtitle, The Story of the Neuron, because he crafted his image through his autobiography, and he discloses what he wishes to disclose. And whenever I had a secondary piece of evidence, I would hold it up against his recollection of events. The book is, you know, a Spanish-speaking native Spaniard friend of mine said that he writes like a country boy who's trying to seem urbane. And that was really true. It's this florid, you know, romantic language. And he's the picaresque hero who's, you know, raiding orchards and goofing off in class. And so I had to dig really hard for this stuff to build around that, because it's not enough to just repeat what somebody says about themselves. I did find a good blueprint in his own histological technique, which is you dissect tissue and you stain it using whatever kind of method, and then you hold it up to the light and see what's there. But you always know that what you're seeing is the result of a method. You know, cells are mostly water. You can't see them without a stain. So I applied a stain, so to speak, to the raw material of his life and looked at it in the light, and that's what I wrote.
Sometimes when he's really over the top, even you say, like when he says he crafted a flute that could reach notes that no other flute has ever
reached. Yeah, it's so endearing though. I find it so endearing. Yeah. It's so ridiculous, you know, and it's so harmless actually, you know. It's narcissism in a way, like not in the clinical sense, but I find it also kind of charming the way that an insecure boy who wants to seem, you know, like the best at everything. I recognize that quality.
It's like the torture in the school. And I'm wondering, could it have really been that bad? Could they?
Yeah,
really?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the other thing, well, as far as the abuse from his father, I actually think it was probably worse than he.
Maybe. Because
he glosses over that. And I think that was too painful to recount. And I have his brother's account, luckily, about how bad it was. And then I have like some letters later in life where he seems to look back on that time, but not want to get into it. There's a hesitancy there that seemed to speak a little bit louder than his actual words about it.
It's funny, you know, you say picaresque, the reviews say picaresque, and I think of, like, I don't know. Oh, and then Robinson, yeah, he read the classics, and a lot of the classics that he read were of that nature, whether it was Robinson Crusoe or The Count of Monte Cristo. And that was surprising to me. Because it was a list of, like, right out of the canon, you know,
yeah,
of what he read. Was it,
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is that was an act of rebellion because his father actually did not allow works of fiction in the house. So his autobiography is like a sort of maybe like a final FU to his father. Like, not only have I read all of this, but I'm a character. I am also part of this tradition. And I loved how much he loved literature because I studied literature, and literature has an immersive, transporting effect on me and has shaped my character and my understanding of myself. And that certainly was how he experienced literature as well. And so before I could get into the science as much, before I had taught myself about all that, I read his autobiography and read the literary references and felt like, oh, this person is actually like me and the people that I know who grew up reading literature and pretending we were whoever the characters were.
Yeah, and the other thing is, if you look at his bibliography, whether you do it on Wikipedia or whether you do it on Amazon, I mean, his science fiction, at which you on Amazon, everything's like $200, you know, you can't find it on Amazon that is still in print. And the Vacation book, and then Year 6000. And plus, that brings the other thing is, how did he, you know, all these manuscripts, tens of thousands of letters. I know we're distracted today and we don't have time to do that, but I can't imagine how he would have had time to have accomplished all that he did, in addition to spending most of his time with an eye to the microscope and staining things.
Yeah, incredible force of energy and will, really. Those are a couple of the examples I took from his career and his life. I think it came at the expense of, you know, the being the kind of husband and father that we might, you know, expect people to be now or wish that people were. I mean, he wasn't abusive in any way, but he didn't spend a lot of time. He spent rare time with his family. I also think that those were his, whereas we might see writing fiction as kind of fraught and painful, that was his release. That was his way of relaxing. So I don't know that it really necessarily required from him a great grit or anything like that.
True. I mean, my father always said, if you wake up in the morning and you want to go to work, you have a pretty decent life. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. The willpower and the dedication were really, they're such attractive qualities to me about, and, you know, he was motivated in part by selfishness because he wanted to be the most famous scientist and he wanted to elevate Spanish science. But also, I think he was doing it for what he conceived to be humanity. He wanted to increase the wealth of knowledge that we have about, you know, the most hallowed organ in the body. And I think that motivated him every day for quite a long time. I mean, he would work 10 plus hours. He once claimed to spend 20 straight hours at the microscope, which, again, like you were saying before, who knows if that's true, but it was sometime more than I've ever spent at the microscope. So, you know, I certainly respect and admire him for that.
Like I said, I jump around, but only because at my age, if I don't ask you the question, when I think of it, it's gone. So that reminds me of the story when he takes his Zeiss and he goes to the convention and he's waiting, you know, this one eminence Greece, he wants to get his attention and he somehow grabs him. And then all of a sudden, so that story, I thought, okay, well, is this exactly the way it happens? But tell that one because it gives him a really good idea of his ambition, which is what you just spoke of.
Yeah, so he provided the first clear histological, meaning stained tissue histological evidence that the nerve cells are independent, which was the hotly debated point. There were a couple different theories, but he uncovered that nerve cells are like any other cell in the body in the sense that they're anatomically independent. And he knew he had made a breakthrough. He sent a letter to every single scientist whose books he'd ever read and been in conversation with, and nobody responded because he had a funny name and he was Spanish. So he sold some stuff, borrowed some money, got on a train and went to Berlin for this anatomical society convention. And his father, when he was a young child, had taught him to speak French in a it's kind of dramatic, in this cave in the middle of the field in rural Spain. And so he was trying in his halting French to get a hold of anybody. And finally, this guy Kurlicher came and looked under the microscope and realized what Cajal had done and called everybody else over. And then suddenly he was feted as like a hero. But again, it was in the early days, there was a lot of privations and a lot of just putting his faith in his own work and in himself. And that was his first kind of international breakthrough, and it kind of rolled on from there.
Which brings me to another question, which is kind of the heart of the book, which is the Golgi method, histological idea, and the feud, which I also, the feud between the two, which is also kind of funny too, because it's like,
yeah,
being very catty.
Yeah, totally. It's like two kids who are like, this is my sandbox, this is my sandbox. But yeah, so I think that, yeah.
Talk about the idea of what you're doing. I mean, and his artwork and the actual slides are fascinating, but talk about what Golgi did that allowed him, and then as he improved the method, to see things that no one else had ever seen.
Yeah, so like I said, you know, cells are mostly water. So if you don't stain them, you can't see them. You would just see right through the tissue. There's a history of histological staining, ink and wine as a fixative, and all these different chemicals that have been tried by different, you know, investigators. And then there was a sort of boom in the mid to late 19th century of these synthetic dyes that were developed kind of by histologists, specifically German histologists, with the sort of dye industry, which is an interesting sort of sub-history of all this, like how different colors came about. And this young Italian doctor, Golgi, was working at a mental hospital, and in the kitchen after his shift, he was playing around with these different chemicals, in order to illuminate the cellular architecture of tissue, you have to fix it so it doesn't decompose. After you dissect it, it will decompose unless you fix it almost like a photograph. You need a chemical fixative. Then you clear it and wash it and all these different steps. And then you apply this bath of chemicals. And Golgi did so with what was called silver nitrate. And he achieved this incredibly stark, beautiful black reaction, which is what he called his stain. But it had fallen out of favor for about a decade later because it was inconsistent and it showed up artifacts that weren't actually part of cells. And so it was hard to discern what was the architecture and what was just random blobs of chemical stains. Cajal revived it and was able to improve it enough that he could get consistent revealing results. It was only because he was the only one who was trying it anymore. And he was after he saw the first stain and the possibilities of this, of the black reaction, he wouldn't let it go, essentially. So then he discovered neurons using this stain that was invented by Golgi, his Italian rival. Then they were both awarded the Nobel Prize in 1906, and they had to appear in Stockholm together. And Cajal was trying to meet him, and Golgi was away, and there was all these missed connections. And it was very icy between the two of them. And remained so. There were two camps. There were the neuronists and what were called the reticularists. They were the ones that believed in Golgi's theory that the brain is one interconnected fibrous network, so that would make the brain different than every other living thing, which, you know, isn't intuitive now, but back then, because the brain has this special function that we all recognize, perhaps it was differently composed somehow. People bought into that, but the Cajal-Golgi feud is one of the great feuds in the history of science. I found it, like you were saying, to be rather funny in parts and revealing of, I think, an aspect of the character of scientists where, you know, we would all like to hope that people doing such serious work for the sake of mankind are above all of these catty, like you said, interactions with each other, but not so. People are people, and it certainly brings out the worst when there's an argument about primacy.
And it's really not subjective there because you have the letters, but it's so what I hate, which is this passive aggressive letter in which he praises him for what a great guy is. And then he says, unfortunately, you're completely wrong.
Yeah, it's so funny because they start the letters by like, my esteemed and respected colleague, you know? And then he goes on to say, you're wrong. And like, you've always been wrong. And, you know? But like the esteemed and respected colleague part, it's so funny to me, just the pomp and circumstance around it. Anyway, I was glad that his life included that feud because it just kind of makes for good story in and of itself when that arrives in the book.
Well, this statement is kind of cancel culture now, but it's like when you see, when a woman says to another woman, is that what you're going to wear tonight? You know, it's like that kind of statement.
Yeah, we're all guilty of it. I certainly react that way a lot of times when I don't feel like saying the truth to somebody, let's say.
Yep. And that, in my labyrinthine pattern of questioning or conversation, leads to this concept of network. Because when you read the book, all of a sudden you're thinking, wait a minute, this is all a network now. This is more a network extraneous to ourself than we could possibly have imagined or anyone could have imagined. And so let's go through the dichotomy of the different schools of thought, which we, with regard to nerve endings, synapses, connection or not.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think one of the richest parts of this story of the neuron is the history of metaphors about the brain, which are ancient, and they always reflect whatever technological achievement that culture or civilization had arrived at the time. So in Greece, you have a catapult. In ancient Egypt, it was the slag that would run off of corrugated metal. I think I'm getting that right. And then in the 19th century, there was the railroad. And so a lot of theories about how signals, because electrophysiologists had discovered that the body conducted electricity, including the brain. So the question was, how did these signals, it couldn't be that they all signals just went out in all directions at once, because there would be no order. It would be total chaos, and you'd never have a behavior that you could replicate. You know, you need to have pathways of behavior. So the telegraph became the operative metaphor in the sort of mid to late part of the 19th century. And most anatomists preferred that as an explanation. The problem with a telegraph is you have fixed lines and poles. What Cajal preferred was a naturalistic metaphor, which I think was inspired by his upbringing, not in a major city, but in the country. He had this understanding of the nervous system as organic, composed of these organic parts that could change their shape, like the epigraph, that, you know, you could sculpt the actual elements and change the pathways. And so that was the neuron theory that he founded and championed. Someone else named it, but it was based almost entirely on his work. The other idea was this telegraph reticular system. There are reticula in other parts of the body. It's like an enmeshed, rigid network of fibers. So the problem is, we all know that when we learn a new thing, like, you would expect that if you learn something new, that if your assumption is that the brain controls behavior, then if you learn something new, the brain should change in some way to reflect that. Because if you just had the same pathways, how would you be producing a new behavior? So the reticular theory couldn't account for that, because it posited these rigid pathways. And the neuron theory was, you know, led to Cajal's championing of the term plasticity, which is so in vogue today. You hear that in education and politics and economics, but that's only possible based on his view of the neuron theory, which is that it's composed of individual elements that can change and alter their connections.
Which is one of the reasons I think he's not switched, but part of his life was devoted to like taking a look at the cerebellum or at youngsters and in terms of young animals, because it was so much easier because things hadn't developed. The sheath was not as thick. Explain that a little bit, because that's an interesting concept. I hadn't thought of it before.
Yeah, there's a long tradition of studying embryonic animals because their nervous systems are less complicated, as you say. So if you look at an adult animal, you'll see this tangle of fibers, and you can't tell where does one end and one begin? Is it all one fiber? What are the different pathways? We can't even trace them because they're so intricate. But in a younger animal, but before nerve fibers develop, what's called the myelin sheath, which is resistant to staining. It's almost like a protective covering. And so the stain doesn't penetrate as well. You don't get a clear enough picture of the fibers. There were other people who were studying the embryos of a nervous system in embryos, but Cajal, I think in part, he chose birds he loved birds and he had been incubating eggs since he was a kid. Like another one of these cool examples of how, you know, just like he was a barber's apprentice and his colleagues marveled at how he could slice brain tissue as thinly and precisely as a machine. So he loved birds and he would hatch these eggs and study the embryos, or before they hatched, study the embryos. And he was able to see this sort of primitive, simplified nervous system before things got too complicated to parse out. By doing that, that was a major insight, studying embryonic animals and changing the Golgi stain, iterating it so that it was more reliable and powerful. Those are the two insights that really led to his great discoveries.
And then not only drawing those, but drawing the much more complicated. We were just talking about that book, The Beautiful Brain, which is, I have this here, it's in our bookstore. And as you were saying, it was an exhibit, and then they created this book out of the exhibit. But how did, you know, we were talking about his life and how much time he spent on these things. This must have taken so much time to do this in such an intricate and minuscule manner. Right.
I just love that drawing. I think it's like one of the most striking aesthetic objects I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you take into account that it turns out he wasn't necessarily replicating one slide, he was interpreting many different slides of the same area. He decided what area was what. He decided this is one area with this type of cell. This is another area with this type of cell. So that's a Purkinje cell in the cerebellum, but that was like many, many, many Purkinje cells. And he collated them and synthesized them into one representative image. And the amazing thing is that those are technically fictional images. That neuron on the cover of that book never existed that he observed. Yet the images stand in so faithfully for actual neurons that they're still used in neuroanatomy textbooks today. So he created an image that was, you know, and there's a colleague of his, a student of his, who said that Cajal used to look at neurons in the morning, then go for a long walk, and then come back and draw them. So there's memory, there's interpretation, subjectivity, there's other form, like they're creative pieces of work in addition to being scientifically faithful, which I was blown away by, that those two things could happen at the same time.
Yeah, and you're talking about him taking a walk, and that reminds me, I guess the word's eidetic, but I mean, he was able to hold seven slides in his head.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And
if he had a genius talent, it was his visual power, memory, and like you said, his ability to hold many images in his mind at once. He had other like exceptional sort of human qualities, but I think ultimately it was that ability to hold images in his mind, then synthesize them. He was also such a skilled draftsman. There was it was kind of the perfect combination of all of his skills and traits. What he ended up doing was, I think, the best way to apply all of that in the end. It's kind of a fortunate marriage of a place and a time and where the science was and what the major question was and how it needed to be answered and what talents and skills he could marshal to sort of answer that call.
Which again, in my mind, reminds me of another. First, he also had enough time to have 12 kids, which takes a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I think he had seven, but that may as well be 12. And yeah, they used to see him on the weekends. He'd take them to the park and the cafe. But when he was in his room working, he was not to be disturbed. And his wife, whom he credits repeatedly for keeping peace in the home and educating the kids, and she was... there's almost nothing from her hand that survived. Like, I had to work really hard to get both of his wife and his mother. And I found one letter from his wife, and it was in response to the faculty at the University of Barcelona congratulating her when Cajal won the Nobel Prize. And she basically said, "I did what any Christian wife would do. I supported my husband and I kept the peace in the house." That was it. So yeah, she was also a complicated and interesting person, but there wasn't as much material. There was one incident where their young child died and there was a legend about Cajal not answering his wife knocking, you know, feverishly on the door, but that may have been apocryphal. It's hard to tell. Anyway, he didn't have time for everything, let's just say.
Yeah, and there was a moment in the book which I couldn't figure out whether I felt sympathy or resent it when his daughter got meningitis and he knew it was fatal. I couldn't really tell whether he had this empathy towards her or just felt about her situation as he would any other scientific issue.
Yeah, it's controversial because there was a show, a multi-part, I guess you'd call it a TV series in the 80s in some Spanish national TV that depicted Cajal as kind of a callous genius with no time for his family. There was a biography in the 60s by a guy that married one of his granddaughters and supposedly had access to family stuff that no one else did, that, you know, Cajal was, he was a Francoist, this biographer, and it was like Cajal cared so much about his country that he sacrificed the daughter. But his kids were very vocal against that. And I found in the end that I believed them because I didn't feel, and it was, their account was consistent with the way that he behaved towards a son of his that died, not as young, but in his 20s. And I didn't see him being, he describes in his autobiographies like weeping at the microscope. You know, I think he just wasn't capable of handling the pain of that. He couldn't confront that. And the laboratory was always his refuge. And the microscope was always his refuge in the world of the infinitely small, as he called it. So he felt more comfortable among neurons than he did his dying daughter. But on other nights, apparently he would bring his laboratory station in her room to keep her company. So yeah. It's hard to say.
Yes, it also reminds me of the footnotes and the illustrations in this book. The footnotes alone, if you decided to go down the rabbit hole of each, we could have an interview for years and it would take me years. But did you ever get a chance to, I have no idea, to talk to any of his descendants, his great-great-great-grandchildren, or anybody? Yeah.
So when I started this project, broadly speaking, to write a biography of Cajal, it started with a translation I was going to do of one of his books in Spanish, and I had to engage his granddaughter, who's now deceased. And let's just say that I had a very difficult time getting her to agree to the project. And even though once it entered the public domain, which was 2 years after I initially engaged her, I was going to be able to do it anyway. I was offering her a role in the process, and that was tough and confusing and a big roadblock. But yeah, she I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but she would say things like Cajal, you know, is responsible for inventing the computer, you know, and she would never let his intellectual property belong to anyone else as long as she lived. And so she was kind of not, she was a little bit, she was hard to negotiate with, let's just say. I remember I hired a Spanish lawyer to work out a deal with her, and I thought it was going to take a day because I thought she would want Cajal's books to be publicized in America. My lawyer played me a tape of the phone call with her, and she was just raving in Spanish, you know, just a mile a minute raving. And so I said, I'm going to shut this down until it enters the public domain. And that's when I ended up doing the Oxford University Press book. So it turned out okay. And that material actually wasn't available 2 years before the Dream Diary of Cajal was. So it turned out better for me, but it was. So to answer your question, no, I have had contact with children of his main disciples who are, you know, a few of whom are scientists. And so there is like the Cajal scientific family behind me.
Actually, she sounds a little bit like him.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, she was a source. I used her as a source. She gave some interviews and wrote a newspaper article. So she had an interesting, you know, a child's view of her grandfather, which I appreciated. And I understood her position because the government of Spain had been saying they would make a museum with Cajal's artifacts since Franco. Well, actually, anyway, Franco's a sort of different story, but it's been talked about for many, many years and they've never done it still to this day. And I think she felt that the Cajal Institute, which is a scientific organization that houses his artifacts, had stolen them from her. And I actually sort of deduced in the end that she actually had some case in a sense. So I understood her position, but I just couldn't reason with her. And it's very, I'm sure you've talked to people where you can't reason with them and it can get kind of frustrating and you kind of have to.
After practicing law for 45 years, yes.
I'm sure, yeah.
It's funny, even you sounded resentful when you said the museum had never been constructed.
I'm so pissed about that. And I'll go on any podcast, anywhere. I'll go in writing. I'll tell it to the people's face. It's a total travesty. And you want to talk about pettiness, the bureaucrats in Spain who should be pushing this through tomorrow and can't get it together. The artifacts, all his slides, all those drawings, they're all in a storage closet in a laboratory in Madrid. It's a total travesty. And I wrote it in the epilogue of my book, and I know many of the principals involved. I've seen the pettiness, and it's just inexcusable, honestly. His house on basically the Central Park West equivalent of Retiro Park in Madrid is now a luxury units, you know, apartment units, and or maybe even a hotel, but traces of him are disappearing. It's horribly sad and upsetting. There needs to be a museum right now, and I'm sure that people would visit from far and wide.
It goes back even to another story in the book where the one scientist gave short shrift to Spain because he went to the museum there. Right. It was just a microscope.
Yeah.
And he asked about it and they go, well, we don't actually use it.
Yeah.
Use the
microscope. That was the scientific culture. I mean, one of Cajal's greatest achievements was really elevating Spanish science. And at the Cajal Institute, those scientists are leaders in the world, and they do great work. And yeah, I wish I could do, you know, this has been something that people that I know from the Cajal Institute have lobbied towards the legislature in Spain. Like it's a huge disagreement, and I was glad that the work that you showed on that in the beautiful brain book did go around about four or five North American museums. But part of the reason I thought it might be good to write a book is because maybe that would help put pressure on people to make a museum.
Like I said,
I almost didn't get into the archive. It was like,
it's
so crazy. I can't even begin to tell you.
Well, so I feel proud of myself because without even knowing what I was going to be talking about, there in my bookstore are five copies of this book. You know, I want to take credit for it, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, Cajal was, I know the great man view of history is not in vogue these days, but on the merits of his life and work, he was an astonishing, extraordinary individual. I'm not making any kind of a case for individuals in general, but his contributions, I mean, he really belongs in Pasteur, Galileo, Einstein, Darwin territory. And I couldn't believe when I started this project that I had never heard of him, let alone, you know, other people in him. I was like, wait, neurons are so, every book talks about neuro this, neuro that, and nobody knows the man behind it. So I thought it would make a great book. He's such a fascinating, colorful character, and the science is so cool. So that was what motivated me.
I mean, your passion for this guy comes through so intensely. How did it happen? I mean, how come you are? I mean, I can see you discovering this, but it's like you really, it's taken years of your life and you're not done yet. What is it? I mean, why?
It was like, honestly, it was kind of one of those experiences like when you fall in love. Like true love.
I was going to say that. I didn't want to say that. I wanted you to say that.
No, it's true. I was at a certain point in my life when I needed inspiration and I saw that Purkinje cell. Well, actually, first I saw a different cell, but I just felt this incredible awakening in my physical body. Like it was a transcendent experience. I can't describe or compare. And I just followed his example. I felt like he gave me my life for that period because everything I was doing was for the project, and there would be no project if he hadn't given his life to contributing scientifically to humanity. And, you know, it was many years, it was 12 years in the end, and he was great company. And I found learning about him and his science and his world to be endlessly rewarding, gratifying. And I mean,
can you imagine if he was alive today listening to you saying this? Like, he would be so happy, wouldn't he?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't a fan of the newspapers at the time, their portrayals of him. But I'd like to think that I think of myself as one of his students. And that carries for me a responsibility. I know he wasn't perfect, and I don't portray him as such in my book, but I do think that his life and work taught me a lot about how to be a person. And I think my book is paying back that debt, actually, like beyond how it does commercially or critically. I've now completed my debt to him. He gave me like 12 years of my life to have something to devote myself to. And I gave his legacy this book. And I feel like that's where I'm at with it now.
Yeah, when I read the quote in the book from Leonardo, I thought, wait a minute, he's kind of like Leonardo. And then I thought, well, he's not a polymath. And then I thought, well, actually, yeah, he kind of is. And so I'm not saying he's like Leonardo da Vinci, but I'm saying just the anatomical drawings of Leonardo are like these, only these are an inner world. He was drawing, well, you know, the same kind of thing, but still the beauty of it, as I said in the introduction, and the precision is amazing. And I just can't even imagine myself even beginning to do something like this. But
the layers for me of the drawings, you know, when I first saw it, aesthetically, it's striking, obviously. It has the epistemologically, it means the neurons that are in our head, but it's also a subjective account of what a person in time thought that the seat of the mind looked like.
Everything I've read seems to say that they are still real. People are still relying on these drawings to a certain
absolutely extent. Absolutely.
And why? You have scanning electron microscopes. There's
well, because
kinds of-
I think there's a level of clarity and detail. And I think that they're also inspiring, because I think that in the images represent all of the labor and the love of a scientist who spent that many hours over years producing the image. And they're beautiful. I mean, I think even scientific textbooks are not immune to the allure of beauty.
Have you ever like looked on YouTube and you look at these algorithms of fractals, you know, that go down layer after layer after layer? He's essentially doing that without the benefit of a computer or...
I think they should be in, you know, they made the rounds to some university museums. I think they should be in the collection of a major art museum somewhere, and it should be the Spanish ones, because that would be apt. But there's still this bias against science and scientific information. The art world thinks that science is wonky and technical and, you know, data driven, and now it is more like that. But there was no separation, like you said, with Leonardo, between art and science, and Cajal's in that tradition.
Yeah. So, and the thing about it is, though, is that isn't it interesting how you can't really explain anything to anybody about the natural world without, as you were earlier talking about, metaphor? I mean, I'm looking at I'm looking at my desktop. It's not a desktop. I have all these windows open with notes and the Zoom window and my introduction, and you're here, but it's not a desktop. But I can't even imagine it as anything other than a desktop, because I don't even know what would it be.
Yeah, well, that's to me the lesson that I learned about science, which can be, I could see how someone who had faith in science as objective being sort of cut down by this, but it's inextricable from language and from context, you know, context including language, context of someone's surroundings, their environment, their childhood, how they see. How you see is, I think now we understand, determined by much more than just, you know, your ocular nerve, you know? So I think that what I love about those images of Cajal's are that they represent all of that. To me, everything in the book, like everything that I read in the book to explain or depict how he was and where he lived and how, that's all in the drawings to me. Like I, in a way, like I saw the drawings at first, and the book is just a way of expanding on that initial experience of the drawing, which really went deep into me. So all of that context, I'm just trying to provide all this context so that you can experience the drawings more fully.
So if you look through the microscope and you study and you come up with theories about whether we have a network embedded in us or not, or whether that network extends to the outside world, it's like, okay, as I've asked every neurophysicist or anybody I've interviewed who deals in the area, where is the seat of human consciousness? And I don't know. So he considered this, and he dealt with it, but and the epigraphs even discussed to a certain extent. So where lies the seat of human consciousness?
It reminds me of this quote, and I can't remember where it's from, but God is the search for God. To me, devoting your life to finding the seat of consciousness, he acknowledged towards the end that it was impossible, that he wasn't going to do it, that we probably wouldn't even figure out the architecture of his cerebral cortex in full for another 100 or so years. And yet he woke up every day and tried to find that seat. In a way, it's like Quixote. That was the impossible dream. And to live that dream, despite it being impossible, to me is like a great teaching. Like why do we do that? You know, because the search for it is a way of experiencing, to search for consciousness is a way of experiencing our own consciousness. And in the end, what's there to search for?
Well, it's like you were saying, it's kind of recursive, and you're trying to examine a tool with the tool itself.
Right.
And that's where the solipsistic thing comes in. But do you think essentially all of us, this has nothing to do with the book, but do you think everybody's like tilting at windmills with regard to this quest for why we are who we are, why we're aware, why I'm looking out this window and I'm aware I'm looking out this window and looking at the beautiful light and the leaves? Where does that awareness come from? Do you think it's just I go on and on. So he wakes up in the morning and he wonders about it. And like you probably wake up and I wake up going, what the hell is all this? I don't know where I'm going. That's the end.
I don't know. I mean, I would ask a neuroscientist. My sense, I don't know much. Well, I know some about contemporary neuroscience, but less than I do about the history. I think we know a lot more about the brain than we did in Cahal's time, obviously. Eric Hendel once made the point that the neuroscience textbook is increasing by some number of pages every 10 years. But the question about why is consciousness what it is and how does it come about, we've made no progress. And that, so whether we will or how, or whether we can, who knows? But I admire people who are trying, you know? I think that there's a lot of great neuroscience being done. It's important to study small, you know, cellular level, circuit level, reflexes, behaviors, all these different ways that it operates. I hold a special place in my heart for the Quixotes, you know, and that's Cajal's legacy to me. He would object to the methods, and he probably object to the personalities behind them. But I think the spirit of, he wanted to understand the whole brain. He wanted to understand consciousness. And I think the people that are aiming at that now, whether they'll succeed or not, I find it to be compelling from a story point of view.
I used to date a woman who worked for Eric Kandel. I really dated her because she knew a lot of stuff. It was kind of like you and your love affair. It was just like, she's so smart and she worked with Eric Kandel and he won the Nobel Prize. And I'm like, yeah, this is well worth it for me.
Yeah, he's a great scientist. And yeah. I've spoken to him before about the project, and you know, neuroscientists love Cajal, and I've seen people with tattoos of his drawings, not just one person, multiple people. And he's been an inspiration to generations of scientists even to this day. And I think that that's just so cool, you know? I think that's so cool.
In a more prosaic way, basically, I've always thought, you know, and again, it goes back to me in the bookstore. It's just like, figure the point of your life is just to gain as much information as you can while you're here. And even if it is something, as you were saying, that you're not going to reach, at least you can strive for it. You know, I think it is what makes humanity somewhat divine in a sense. There's this dichotomy, you know, we get up and go to the ATM at Bank of America and take money out at the same time. We're trying to figure out what this all is. You know, there's like this two different ways of living. There's a quotidian day-to-day basis of living. And then there's this idea that I want to understand what all of this is.
Yeah, and Cajal was that type of person. I think with the biography, I wanted to portray, you know, I wanted people to get a sense of how was he at the cafe? How was he with his,
yeah,
with his, but also that when he went into the laboratory, and also when he wasn't in the laboratory, but there was this space that he consecrated for the most sanctified discoveries and thoughts and ideas about humankind. And I think that the duality is, which isn't really a duality, it's the same, but the expressions of that a person's life could express both that kind of depth and profundity and far reach of thinking, and also, you know, wakes up, puts his clothes on and goes to teach and is kind of boring, goes to a cafe, you know, makes jokes in poor taste, you know, that can be one person, all of that.
It's funny when you drill down to conversations like this that end up being like dorm room conversations to 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Everything gets kind of fuzzy, you know, like, yeah, what exactly are we saying here? But which leads to my concluding question, like, because I haven't read it, but I will, the dream journals. I mean, what does that show? I have no idea what the dreams are like. Tell us a little bit about that so you can say more.
So Cajal hated Freud because Freud was more, for two reasons. Freud was more popular even in Spain, and because Freud was not scientific enough for Cajal. So Cajal actually represents what's now called a neurobiological school of psychology, where he believed that, and he did experiments on, you know, how do blind people, what's going on in the ocular nerve and cortex of blind people when they dream? Is there any activity? Is it all memory, or are they actually, is there any input, you know, visual input? And so he decided to keep a diary to prove Freud wrong. And he did the opposite, because it's a sort of master stroke of repression. It's like, you know, he's got a daughter that died young. There's a dream where he's holding his infant daughter as he's drowning. And then he'll say, no Freud here, you know? And so it was another window into his character. He had such great insight about his own mind and about the human condition, obviously about the brain, but he still couldn't get over certain things. And in the end, he decided not to publish the manuscript, but neither did he decide to destroy it. He gave it to a disciple that was a Freudian. So I think that he might have hoped it would be published someday. It was passed down from that disciple to another disciple. During the war, the person had to flee Spain, and he was like copying it out all over Europe. And then finally it surfaced in 2014. And I saw it. I was in Spain. I was at the National Library. And I just thought, this is incredible. It's a great way to describe these two different schools of thought about psychology. And it's also just such an amazingly revealing document. And it endeared me to Cajal even more, because it was so transparent. The thing about Cajal is he's so transparent, even when he's trying to pretend, you know, that he's so tough, or that he's, you know, the best at this, or that, you know, he knows more than Freud does. And it's obvious, you know. And I think that's a lovely, charming quality.
It's like dragging the iron stick. I have no idea unless you have corroborating sources on that one, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's less about whether he dragged an iron stick or why would he tell people that he did. It's the same idea.
Exactly.
So the dreams are really cool. I mean, I think they're a little, well, whatever. I don't know how much they go for these days, but it's the beginning is like a proto-biography of Cajal, but also of Freud. And there are a lot of biographies about Freud, but I think in the context of this particular rivalry that illustrates the different schools of psychology, it's interesting. And then the dreams are just anyone. I mean, dream journals are so intimate, and that's how these were. They could have been more intimate if he was more honest about his feelings, but nonetheless, his lack of honesty about his feelings is intimate in the end.
Well, now I think what I'll do is, well, I'll read it, then, well, I'll get it. And then I can do a little display in the front of the store.
Yeah, triple Cajal, yeah.
Yeah, Cajal Corner. Right. Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Ben. This was great. And it really amplifies what I learned from the book. And, you know, I don't think I'm going to get to your point as far as this, but I'm certainly going to delve further into it. And as I said, the notes are so great that wherever you stop, you can find something that's fascinating. So thanks for doing the work. And thanks
for being so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk.
Okay.
Okay. Take care.
You too.